Welcome to this event with Stuart Alden and Dr. Ramadan. The Geographical Society is very pleased this evening to welcome Stuart Alden, who is Professor of Geography at Durham University. He has a perhaps unconventional background, as he originally studied politics and modern history with a PhD in political theory, and he became a professor just 12 years after finishing his undergraduate degree. So any third years here, maybe that's something to aim for. So early work on early work on Heidegger, Foucault and Lefebvre led him into ideas of space and therefore geography. His interest now lies somewhere in the intersection of politics, philosophy and geography. His work on history and concepts of space will be known to many geographers, as will his work on territory. Alden's 2009 book, Terra and Territory, won prestigious awards from the Association of American Geographers and the Political Geography Speciality Group. And Stuart is also current editor of Environment and Planning D, Society and Space. And then in 2011, just last year, he won the prestigious Royal Geographical Society Murchison Award for contributions to political geography. And then Dr. Ramadan, you will recognise as a lecturer in geography from Cambridge. He teaches undergraduates on Foucault, the War on Terror and Risk. His research interests lie in political and cultural geography, particularly geopolitics, sovereignty, nationalism and migration, with a focus on refugees and refugee camps in the Middle East. So join me in extending a warm welcome to Professor Stuart Alden and Dr. Adam Ramadan.
Thanks very much, John. It's very nice to be introduced as well. But of course, the big star of this evening is Stuart. Stuart, as John set out, you had an unusual sort of progression from politics and modern history through bits of philosophy and political theory through to geography. So I wonder, do you think of yourself as a geographer or something else? And do those sort of labels make any sense to you anyway?
Okay, can I just say thank you first for the invitation? I'm grateful for that, and it's nice to be here. And thank you, Adam, for volunteering or being volunteered to ask some questions of me. What am I? I don't know. People now seem to label me a geographer. Outside, if I go and give a talk in another discipline, people always introduce me as a geographer. And then sometimes after I've spoken, they're like, "You're really in a geography department." I don't tend to self-identify as a geographer still. I still think that's a little bit of a stretch. I mean, I don't have any qualifications in geography. I mean, I don't even have, you know, GCSE geography. I quit geography as soon as I could at school, and geography not being what you think it is kind of was really true, because when I rediscovered geography when I was a graduate student, I discovered that it actually wasn't what I thought it was, and that actually it could be really interesting, and all the sorts of things that I was doing in the work I was doing within a politics department, I could do within geography, and I could do them, I thought, in more interesting ways than I could do them in politics. So in retrospect, it was the best career move I ever made to jump ship and become a geographer, or become in a geography department. And I used that for a while of, you know, I'm employed by a geography department or something of that nature to say what I did. But really, I think what I do is the history of ideas. And the history of ideas doesn't naturally fit in any discipline. I mean, yes, you have some people who do history of ideas in history departments, but you have people who do, say, the history of science. Or you have, you know, particularly here at Cambridge, you have people who do history and philosophy of science. Or you have people who are historians of their discipline in a whole range of disciplines. So history of ideas makes sense to me. And I think I can maybe claim some kind of training in that. And I used to do the history of political ideas, and now I do the history of geographical ideas, or something of that nature. That, for me, is where I feel most comfortable.
Okay, that's great. You're well known, I guess, in geography as a theorist, as a scholar of ideas, as you said. A lot of the audience this evening will be undergrads, they'll be writing their dissertations, sort of for them, why is theory important in geographical research?
I suppose the thing is, if you don't think you're doing theory, you just haven't questioned what you're doing. You're working with a naive empiricism or something of that kind of nature. You just haven't reflected on the concepts that you're using. You're not reflecting on what counts for you as evidence, how you can make a truth claim, how you can make any kind of judgment. As soon as you start to step back from the work and make those kinds of claims, you're doing something that's related to theory. Now, there are ways of doing that that are more or less sophisticated or more or less engaged. And, you know, I'm not saying everybody in their undergraduate dissertation needs to go away and engage with, you know, Foucault or whatever in huge detail. But unless you have some kind of distance from the things that you're taking as evidence to make the case that you're doing, you're unquestioning those kind of theoretical assumptions. So it seems to me that that's a necessary step in it, in any kind of work. It's not geography alone that needs this. But if you look at, I mean, geography as a discipline is interesting on this because geography kind of came to theory quite late, and a lot of people were resolutely anti-theoretical, and I think a lot of people still are that way. But it's the one bit of the book that people do still read, but the end of David Harvey's explanation in geography has this passage where he says, this is 1969, and he says, the slogan for the next decade, the one that we should put up on our office walls, is "By our theories, you should know us." And it is that sort of, for him at the time when he's writing that book, it's positivism. It's this sort of a fully rigorous spatial science. That's, and Harvey obviously moves quickly away from that as his focus. But that reflection, to have that in the late 60s as the sort of the culmination of one movement, and then as Harvey moves into Marxism, that's the introduction of Marxism into geography to a large degree. That's quite late compared to other disciplines. And geography discovers post-structuralism later than many other disciplines and so on. So geography is maybe a little bit more aware of these questions than disciplines where it's just been natural and that you would have been trained in that in different ways. Yeah. So I think, yeah, not everybody needs to go away and do kind of full-on heavy-duty theory, but some critical reflection about those questions seems essential to me.
Okay. I wonder how good geography is at theory now, though. You're obviously someone who's worked with a wide range of theory and worked through a lot of the work of a lot of thinkers. Do you think that geographers are good at theory? Do you think we, perhaps, do we import too much theory without producing enough of our own? I mean, this claim by our theories, you should know us. Well, that's a case for producing geographical theory, isn't it? And the quantitative revolution is very much in those veins. But then going to import Marx or importing ideas from post-structuralism or whatever, should geographers produce more theory? Do we just consume theory?
I don't know about necessarily geographers need to produce more theory, but I do think what you can track the way that geography seems to discover a thinker a few years after other disciplines seem to have discovered that thinker. And that seems to me quite often because geographers need somebody else to do the first preliminary work of the translations, the critical editions, the introductions, the primers, and then geography can discover that thinker and spatialise them, and then they can go off and do their thing with that. And over the last few years, you've seen that happen with, you know, Agamben. There was that moment with him. There was a moment with Alain Badiou. And you could go but further back and say, well, there was a Deleuze moment or a Derrida moment or a Foucault moment or whatever. And I think that if geography's engagement with theory is to become a bit more mature, then maybe geographers need to do some of that work of engaging with and introducing and working with those thinkers rather than being... What's the right word? Rather than kind of relying on the intellectual labour of others in order to do that kind of work. And a book, I mean, I suspect that not many people will read this book because it's quite a specialised study, but Susan Ruddock at the University of Toronto has just translated a book by Pierre Macherey called Hegel or Spinoza, and there's a session on it at the next Association of American Geographers. And I just think it's a really great piece of scholarship. I mean, it's the sort of thing that won't get counted in research assessments and so on, because it's a translation and introduction, which are not sort of things that are necessarily valued in the academy. But it's a really important work of intellectual service or labour to do that work of bringing something like that into circulation. So geography is a discipline. I mean, it's patchy. There are some very good people doing theory, and there's a lot of, oh, I need a reference to this here to make it look like my work's more sophisticated type approaches. And there's a lot of pick and mix. I mean, I've kind of got angry about this before, of just, oh, here's somebody who says something about space, here's somebody else, and you just throw it all in together and mix it up. And
does that not work, then?
I don't think it does. No, I mean, you can kind of tell. I'm quite resistant to that way of doing it. I just think there are things that... It's not that there's one reading of a text, or that what the thinker themselves said with their ideas is the only way you can use and engage with those ideas and so on. But there are multiple but not infinite readings of a text, and some kind of fidelity to what's written and the context in which it was written seems to me to be important. And a lot of these are sort of an odd quotation or an idea torn out of the context, and that's where the, you know, the historian of ideas or the political theorist kind of training in me seems to bristle at that sort of thing. I think that's, for too long, that's been quite common in geography.
Okay. It's interesting you talk about the sort of intellectual labour, and this is something you've been involved with, particularly with the work of Foucault, in doing some translation. I've got this book you edited with Jeremy Crampton, which everybody, of course, will have bought. But you have bits in there that you have translated yourself. I mean, what is the intellectual experience of engaging with... Of course, you read Foucault in French and Heidegger in German, but which not all of us can do. But what's the experience of doing that intellectual labour?
I mean, I've not done much Foucault translation. There are pieces in there that are newly translated, but it was Gerald Moore, who'd been an undergraduate student of mine at Warwick, who did those translations mainly, apart from one in there.
Yes.
Lefebvre is the one I've done the most work on for the translation work, and there's no better way to get to know a thinker's work than trying to translate them, because you have to go over it much more slowly, and you have to keep you have to really, or at least feel that you understand it, even if you don't. But you really need to feel that you understand it in order that you can then try to render it into the target language that you're working into. Mm. And so I suppose it really does force an engagement with it. And all of the main translations I've done have been collaborative. So I did the first rhythm analysis with Gerald Moore, and then with Gerald and Neil Brenner, who some of you might know as an urban, somebody who's engaged in urban theory and urban geography. And when Neil and I were doing the Lefebvre collection, the State Space World collection, we sat and we argued over just about every sentence in that translation about what was Lefebvre trying to say and what was did the English match with that and so on. Mm. And it was just like a very, very high-level seminar, because Neil's terrifying and completely brilliant. And just it was just a very, very high level of engagement that we had to keep working at in order to work this through. Mm. And you get to know this stuff in a way that just reading it in your own language, you read it fast. You maybe read it too fast. You don't struggle over every word. And reading in other languages forces you to do that. That's a very roundabout answer, but it's something about working, being forced to work more slowly with a text, and translation does that, or reading it in a language that you're not so good at forces you to do that.
You've worked a lot on Foucault. And Foucault will be familiar to a lot of the undergraduates here. There is some emphasis on Foucault in the course here in second year and in final year papers. As I say, you've worked a lot on Foucault. You've described Foucault's work as spatial history. And there's the famous interview with Herodot, the French geography journal. So that, although Foucault was not a geographer, there's that long engagement between geography and Foucault. Why do you think that Foucault has had such a strong audience in geography?
Well, it's been patchy. And, I mean, you know, Cambridge is an interesting place to talk about this because, Derek Gregory's role in introducing Foucault into English language debates and the Derek students, some of whom are here, but people like Felix Driver and Chris Philo and Miles Ogborn and that took those ideas and then did something with those. And it was for them, I think, largely the historical works of Foucault that were the inspiration for him. If you look at Felix Driver's Power and Panopticism and put that next to Discipline and Punish, it's picking up ideas and it's going somewhere different. It's looking at it in the English context rather than the French. And it's or if you look at Chris Philo's work on the history of madness in England and Wales, compared to what Foucault was doing around these questions in France and so on. So there's a sort of an attunement or a historical sensibility about how Foucault was working that they were able to pick up on in their own projects. Mm. And that was something that was happening here in Cambridge Historical Geography. I mean, that's the story that... it's actually in that book. Matt Hannah writes a piece, which is kind of like an archaeology of Foucault's reception in Anglo American geography, and that's part of the story that he tells in that book. And what's interesting, what I like about that approach to it, as opposed to, say, the Edward Soger approach to Foucault in geography, which tends to pick the Heterotopias piece, the interview with the geographers that you mentioned in Eridot, or the Space, Knowledge and Power interview with the Skyline Architecture Journal. That's more Foucault as a conceptualizing theorist of space, which actually Foucault's not that great at, because he really doesn't devote much attention to it. That's not really what Foucault's trying to do. He's not trying to do the sort of conceptualization of space in the abstract without the historical development. He's actually, I think, trying to use a spatial lens to write his historical studies, an awareness of where things happen, architecture, design of cities, construction of infrastructures in a country, the movement of people, these kinds of questions. And I think Foucault's much better at that, and that's where I think the most interesting engagement with Foucault's come, rather than a couple of interviews the Heterotopias, of other spaces pieces, a piece that Foucault gave to architects, and then just put in a desk drawer for 20 years, and somebody forced him to publish it just before he died, and he didn't want to publish it. He thought it was an engagement, an interesting moment, but it wasn't a piece that he thought was as worked through as... I mean, it's not on the same level as History of Madness or Discipline of Punishment. And he didn't think it was. And so that I think, is why the historical approach is the most interesting in Foucault.
Okay. You mentioned things that Foucault never intended to be published.
Yeah.
What's been very exciting for Foucault scholars in the last few years has been the publication of his many lecture series that he gave at the Collège de France. Why are these publications so important, given that he never wanted them actually to be published?
I think they're important, or they're of interest, because they talk about a lot of things that Foucault doesn't talk about in the books. And particularly because Foucault died so young, and that a project that he'd been working on for the last decade of his life was left unfinished when he died. Some people are kind of looking for the key to unlock what Foucault was doing, and why did he have the project he was working on, and why was it going in the direction it was, and why did a bit that he'd clearly been working on for a long period of time never get published? Because he wrote... So the fourth volume of The History of Sexuality, which is the one that isn't published, was written before volumes 2 and 3. And although he'd written them in that order, he decided it needed to come in the chronology last. And because Foucault didn't leave a will, but he left a document that was taken to act in the place of a will, which said, my apartment and everything in it, I leave to Daniel Defer, his partner, no posthumous publications. And those were the two things that he'd said, and this was used as his last will and testament. And because the fourth volume existed in manuscript, but it hadn't been finally given the kind of last seal of approval by Foucault, that wasn't published. They got round it with the lectures by saying he gave these lectures in public, they were recorded, the recordings were archived and were publicly available. All we're effectively doing, I mean, this is the legal argument, I think, all we're effectively doing is transcribing them so that they are more widely available. Which is a bit of a, you know, lawyer's way out for this kind of question, but it's that's the basis on which that was made. And when these first started to come out, the first French one was in 97, that was very much what they were doing. If you now look at them, they're very clearly breaking that. I mean, the most recent one out in French, which Daniel Defer, Foucault's partner, edited, is based on the manuscript because the tapes are missing. So that's clearly a posthumous publication. Because it's based on what Foucault left behind. But it's Daniel Defer who inherited all of Foucault's apartment and all of his note files and everything, who's able to do this. So the two things in Foucault's world have become kind of slightly contradictory. And to be honest, I'm very grateful for it, because the most recent course out is amazing. It's fantastic stuff. It really changes the way that we understand Foucault's development.
Absolutely.
So,
we've been looking for the new Foucault for a few years. Is Foucault now the new Foucault?
It's become that, because I mean, when I started my PhD in 94, there were the books that Foucault published in his lifetime. So this was 10 years after Foucault died, and there had been some things, but most of these had been things that Foucault had agreed could come out, and then they'd just been longer in the process And then there were translations coming out. And then in 1994 in French, they published a big four-volume collection called Die Écrits, so sayings and writings or something of that. And it's like things Foucault said and things Foucault wrote that were not in his major published books. And the French version is four volumes of 1,000 pages. I mean, it's a major chronologically ordered work. The English translation, as such as it is a real mess because they themed it rather than did it chronologically. They only translated maybe about, I don't know, a tenth of the material in there. And we printed a lot of things that had been in previous collections. So that there's still a lot of stuff that's in the French in that collection that's not in English. And the problem is that's not likely to be translated because it's not cost effective given that the best bits have been cherry-picked for this so-called essential works thing. So for me, that was the first bit of the kind of the unknown Foucault that I discovered when I was able to look at that. Because what it did was not just bring together pieces that had been published in French in Foucault's lifetime, but pieces that had been published in German and Japanese and Portuguese and so on, and translated them back into French, which is, again, a way of circumventing the legal restriction, or where things had been lost, Foucault's papers had been lost and so on. And that was just opening up a whole range of things that you didn't know about. And the lectures have done the same. There's all sorts of things in the lectures that aren't in the books. But this is the caution, we can't take what Foucault says in the lectures as of the same standing as what he published in the books. And I think that is an important thing. It's the same kind of question that people always have had about Nietzsche. If Nietzsche said it in his notebook, but he didn't publish it in his book, does it outweigh something that he published in a book in his lifetime? And I think the same kinds of questions are important with Foucault. To remember, he's giving this as a lecture. And yes, they're research lectures. Yes, it's an elite institution. Yes, he's charged to talk about his research rather than teach in a more standard way. Yes, he prepares them over the year and so on, but they are still lectures. He's trying out ideas. They're not fully worked through, they're not fully referenced, and so on. So we need to remember that, I think, when we look at them.
Okay. What you've been doing in the last few years is a major research project on territory. this book that I'm holding up, Terror and Territory, was published in 2009. And in the book, really you interrogate the territorial aspects of the war on terror. So, could you tell us a bit about what were your goals in writing the book?
I'd been writing a book on territory, which we might come to, which is the one I've been working on since this came out, for a long time. And it was a very historical project. There's a huge amount of stuff on the Middle Ages in it. And every time I talked about it, I got the kind of so what question, or the kind of how does this matter, or what does this say about what's happening at the moment, and so on. And so it was after Bush got re-elected. That was the moment for me when I thought, I've got to stop shouting at the television and do something, like write something. Because I'd been teaching about the war on terror and so on for a long period. I mean, my job at Durham, the post I was hired for, was a lecturer in political geography. It's not a lecture in theory of geography or history of geographical thought. So political geography is really the area of the discipline that I'm supposed to be working in. And I taught courses on territory and taught contemporary political geography and so on. And I thought, well, I'll put the historical project aside. I'll write a piece which tries to show why the historical conceptual stuff I've already done on territory helps us to make sense of something that's happening at the moment. And that was really the initial aim. And it was going to be a single piece. I sent it to Environment Planning A, and I think probably even before that piece came out, I realised that there were things that hadn't gone into that piece that maybe I could still develop. And then I got asked to do a talk here, and then maybe I got asked to write a piece. Over the next couple of years, I thought, I've got the basis of a book here. And so then I really put the historical project aside for, I don't know, it must have been about a year, 18 months or something like that, and just thought, pull all the material you've already got and write the other stuff that needs to go to make this into a book. So, I mean, in a way, it was a distraction. this is the kind of workaholic coming out, isn't it? Your distractions become books. But that was the initial thing. That was not what I'd intended to do. But it was talking to something that people were interested in, engaged in, and it showed that there was something, there was a reason for the theoretical, conceptual, historical work I've been doing and so on. So it was an attempt to show why territory still mattered and why territory as a lens on the war on terror could say things that other work wasn't, either in international relations, which is a discipline I had much closer affinities to when I was in a politics department, but also that the geographical accounts, as good as they'd been, hadn't taken territory as the way into it. So Derek Gregory's Colonial Present, or David Harvey's New Imperialism, or Neil Smith's Endgame to Globalisation, or these other kinds of accounts, they've gone at this question in a different way. And I thought, well, I know a lot about territory and the history and where the ideas come from, and maybe that can help me say something about what's happening now.
Okay, so what is that yeah. that way in? You write in the book a lot about how the link between territory and sovereignty, for example, has been challenged or is under siege. As I think you said, it was your publisher who wrote that on the back. The link is under siege. But you know, this is about the contingency of sovereignty in the current geopolitical moment. What is that? I mean, how does that tell us something new about the war on terror?
Well, I started reading the neocons, which is not necessarily recommended, but there was something really interesting I thought that was happening in their work, and this was this idea of contingent sovereignty. Mm. That instead of sovereignty being an absolute, which we're often taught sovereignty is. I mean, sovereignty's always been relative and conditional and so on, but we're taught this idea that there is absolute sovereignty, the kind of Hobbesian notion of sovereign, there is the sovereign, and their power is unlimited and undivided and so on. And the United Nations Charter is an attempt to try to enshrine that within international law and within the framework that's working. Mm. That means that, you know, the borders of states are fixed and that the sovereignty within them is the responsibility of the state. Mm. And that interference in internal domestic matters is not something that states should do. Mm. Other states should do. They should not get involved in it. And there was an argument about, so you find it in Philip Bobbitt's book on the Shield of Achilles, or you find it in Richard Haass's arguments, or you find it in some of the more, and those are quite moderate and kind of thoughtful and careful, and then you find it in the really extreme people like Charles Krauthammer, or, you know, making this argument that you can't have sovereignty as this absolute. Sovereignty has to be dependent or contingent on particular modes of behaviour. Mm. And what I thought was interesting was it was a co-option. It was a kind of a taking on of the argument of humanitarian intervention. Mm. And it was broadening it. And that was that was Blair's mistake, or Blair's tragedy, was that Blair couldn't see where you had to draw the line. So that Blair, who'd been one of the advocates for a limited right to intervention in particular instances, Kosovo is a classic example of that. Mm. But there were others for Blair. There was Sierra Leone, there was East Timor, there was the potential for humanitarian intervention that he argued against the Conservative government when they didn't intervene in Bosnia, or the no-fly zones to protect civilian populations in Iraq, etc. So there was that humanitarian argument. If a state is using sovereignty as a shield or a cloak to oppress its civilian population, maybe intervention might be justified. Mm. And the neocons co-opted that to say, if you're harbouring terrorist groups within your borders, and therefore a threat outside those borders, or if you're pursuing weapons of mass destruction, then your sovereignty can also be rendered contingent. And it was the taking of that logic and all of those arguments about the humanitarian intervention into a much broader set of issues that I think was the real shift. That even though the borders of these states would remain fixed, their sovereignty was just entirely open to the US and its allies. Mm. And you know, you can see many examples of that across the world. Israel has always acted in that way towards all of its neighbours. China has co-opted that argument. Russia has co-opted that argument. And so on. So it was an attempt to try to see what's happening with these relations. How is this international legal framework in the United Nations changed? What's happening at the moment, and not simply since September the 11th, but actually that this fits into a wider logic of change.
Okay. There's a recurring theme in the book, isn't there, about continuity? I mean, you start, the opening of the book is the US president making a statement to the American people about an Al-Qaeda terrorist attack on US target, and he's authorized airstrikes against Al-Qaeda targets in response. The twist is that it's Bill Clinton, it's 1998, and it's not Bush in 2001. Yeah. So that emphasis on continuity that keeps cropping up, I wonder what we do with that. I mean, there's a great sense, isn't there, that 9/11 was this watershed moment, it was this great turning point in global geopolitics. Was it or not?
I mean, it certainly gave a kind of an impetus, or it took away some of the reluctance of some people to do these kinds of interventions. Mm. But there were blueprints that were just ready to come off the shelf within the Bush administration. I mean, you just need to read what these people were writing in the Clinton years. Mm. And the arguments about the reluctance of Clinton to intervene and defend American interests abroad and to do all of these kinds of things. And Bush's first cabinet was stacked full of people. Now, Bush comes to power at the beginning of 2001, so this is before this attack has happened. Bush's cabinet is filled with people like Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, and so on, who had all been signatories to the Project for a New American Century Statement of Principles, which was 97, and they'd all been part, or in various forms, of previous Republican administrations, had come up with a sort of a post-Cold War planning for the US military and so on. So it's not like on the 12th of September they sat down and went, oh, how do we make sense of this? They already had a plan for how America was going to try and reinforce its position in the global economy and global politics and so on. And that gave them a moment that allowed them to get a large body of opinion from the liberal kind of wing, I mean liberal in the American sense of liberal, through to the hardline Republican, behind a set of strategies that they would have wanted to have implemented before. I mean, and I think that's the historical record. It's not like you have to really dig deep into an archive to find this. This was all publicly available material. And their speeches were explicit about these kinds of arguments. So I'm reluctant to see it as everything changed, sort of Tony Blair's kind of, you know, that was then, this is now kind of type thing. And if you look at the way that the US reacted to the Clinton speech at the beginning is the reaction to the bombings of the American embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. Or you look at the way that America had reacted even under President Reagan to Libya and the bombing of Libya because of the US, was it US in Germany, US soldiers in Germany, this is 86, this is going back a bit. But you look at the way the US had continually acted in these ways. Look at the Jimmy Carter Doctrine in 1980 about the Middle East as a strategic area of interest and the United States will act in these ways. So you can see this going back, Cold War thinking is, you know, continuity. So. What I was trying to do by doing this was not simply make this a book about the Bush administration. And I do think that there are lessons that go back historically. For me, the big change is the end of the Cold War. And not maybe for the reasons that people think, but sorry, I'm in danger of going on a long time on this one.
That's fine.
The United Nations never worked. The United Nations has got a massive tension in it. And you need, if you look back to what the United Nations was set up for, it was set up to try to stop two things happening again, in crude terms. Never again World War II, never again a war like that, and never again a Holocaust. Now, those are two ideals that most people would sign up to. But what happens if those ideals are in tension? Now, I don't think we see that those ideals are in tension until the end of the Cold War. Because all the way through the Cold War, whenever one, either the US or the USSR, wanted to intervene and do something around these kinds of issues, the other side would superpower veto it at the Security Council. So that it almost, the Cold War, which was often seen as the thing that meant the United Nations never worked as it was intended, I think you can make a case of saying the Cold War actually prevented us from seeing the United Nations always had this problem. Once you get rid of the superpower veto, and quite quickly, Gulf War 1991, the first when Saddam invaded Kuwait, and you have the Security Council backing the US intervention there. Quite quickly after that, it's kind of like, okay, well, if we can do that there, why can't we do that here? Well, what happens with the humanitarian catastrophe that happens after Kuwait has been liberated? What happens if you look at what's happening in Somalia? What happens if you look at Rwanda or Bosnia and so on? And quite quickly you realise there was a real tension here. You can't protect the sovereignty of states within their own borders if you've got this right to intervention. Mm. And if you've got this right to intervention, if you can render the sovereignty within borders contingent, well, why are those borders the thing that has to be fixed? And Kosovo was the moment when that really started to unravel. It's fine to intervene into Yugoslavia to protect the Kosovar people from the Serbians, but you can't then redraw the border to actually protect them longer term. You've got to have some kind of dodgy international protectorate, and it opened up a tension that they didn't really know how to resolve. And I think that tension's there in the founding documents of the UN. Mm. I just think it took a while for us people to notice it.
Mm. Okay. And the most recent controversies in the Security Council have been on Libya, on Syria. I mean, are we seeing something different there? Are we seeing continuity from the Bush to Obama era, or has something changed there as well?
Well, the depressing thing is that there's too much continuity. And I mean, I'd sort of, you know, is there a paper to be written about Obama's war on territorial integrity or something, extending the arguments? Mm. It would just be so depressing to write. I mean, not just because the you know, you can keep listing the depressing events, but the logic is so similar, and that people don't seem to have thought their way through these tensions and ambiguities and problems and so on. And, you know, the Libya one, it was the same kind of, well, we can get away with authorising this in the Security Council, which will give us just enough political cover, but it was just so clear that there was going to eventually be more than simply the no-fly zone reinforcement and so on, and that it was going to be an incremental shift towards that. And now Russia and China are reining back on this because they know if something on Syria, resolution that denounces them for this, what's going to be the next one? And if the United Nations wants to prove it has any... You can't just tell somebody off and then don't not do anything if they don't change your behavior. You have to have this argument for an incremental approach and so on. So I just think it would be just such a depressing paper to have to write, because I think actually the argument I'm trying to make in that book would just hold again for these. Mm. And that's not because I was really prescient in getting that. It's just because it's so similar. Mm. And the idea with Libya, it seemed, was this idea that you could resurrect this ideal of humanitarian intervention, which had been so sullied by 2003 Iraq War and so on. But I don't know. I'm not convinced by that. I don't know. I mean, I haven't really thought these ones through, and because I'm doing other things, and because I don't want to repeat myself, and because I think that it would be depressingly familiar, the story.
Mm. Okay. So having dealt with the distraction of writing terror and territory, you went back to the sort of genealogy of territory, the history of territory, and the next volume of this body of work is called The Birth of Territory, and I've seen on Facebook the manuscript, which is enormous, and the table of contents, which looks incredible. Is this going to be every student's Christmas stocking filler, or is it going to be... Is it just for sort of expert political geographers?
You need a big stocking.
Yes.
I hope it's read by more than just experts in a very narrow field, and but it, by nature of the sorts of things it's talking about, the audience is going to be smaller than this.
Okay.
Because, you know, this is on the war on terror, and everybody knows what the war on terror is. They may not read academic books about the war on terror, but they have some kind of connection to it. You know, it's the book my mum read, kind of, you know. So there's a connection there that, you know, she didn't read the book on Heidegger and so on.
Why not?
Yeah, exactly. It's what I said. but, I mean, it is a more specialist book. It's a more historical book. Over half of the book is on the Middle Ages, which is not, you know, the most sort of exciting topic for many people. I mean, I think it's fascinating. That's why I wrote that much of the book on it. And I think that there's a really, you know, we have this moment of sort of modern political thought in Machiavelli or Hobbes, for instance, as if they sort of came from nowhere or they were a radical break from people before. It's just not true. They're engaging with many people before them, that their books are similar to, they're more similar to people before them than they are to people after them, that they're in the sense an end of a set of debates rather than the beginning of a new set of debates. And I think what I try to do in the book is to pull out some of those themes. But no, I mean, I, I'd be very surprised if it got the kind of notice that that book did. But it's a much better book than that one. I don't mean that. I don't mean when I say things like that. I mean, it's not that I'm comparing it to anybody else's work. But I've got a fairly good sense, I think, of which are my best pieces of work and which are my worst. That's the worst book I've written. I'm really clear on that. But it's the one that's got all the notice. And that's because of the topic. It's got. So, you know, you could write something really thoroughly kind of worthy and detailed, and it's hugely specialist and nobody reads it. And you can write something that's kind of, I mean, you know, I don't think it's that bad a book, and I don't think, but it's not.
Everyone should still buy it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's, you know, it does what it's set out to do. But I don't think it's my best. I mean, I think this History of Territory is the best thing I've done. I mean, I'm very pleased with it. Because I did what I wanted to do with it.
When's it coming out?
I wish I knew. US university presses are many things, but they're not fast. And I mean, with this book, the Terror and Territory book, this drove me absolutely crazy because every day that book was delayed, it was getting, I felt, more and more out of date. So, you know, when I handed in the manuscript, Obama was barely known. When it came out, he'd been president for a year and had won the Nobel Peace Prize. That was very, very frustrating. I mean, it took nearly 2 years from when I submitted the manuscript to when it actually came out. And the same thing is happening with the Birth of Territory manuscript. It's been under final review. I mean, I had an advance contract, but it's been under final review for 8 months. And that book won't date in the same way. I mean, it doesn't really matter when that book comes out, although Durham cares because of research assessments and so on. But it doesn't really matter when that book comes out, so I'm a little bit more relaxed about that than I was with this one, where I was getting more and more annoyed with it. So I hope it will be out next year. Okay. Sorry, that's a long answer to
that's
a short
right,
question.
That's all right.
But the processes of publishing are just, they're very slow, they're very painful sometimes.
There's a section in it on King Lear.
There is.
And one of your three forthcoming book projects is a book on Shakespeare and territory. So why Shakespeare? Everyone in the room will have been forced to read Shakespeare at school at some point. I never thought of his work as an archive for historical geography research. What's the connection there?
I hope it's not just for historical geographical reasons. I mean, you could do a, you could look at Shakespeare's history plays, say, and you could look at kind of the historical geographies of those plays and so on. I hope it's more than that. The idea at the moment, and this is really kind of preliminary, and I've not really said anything about this before, certainly not in public before now. The idea is to take 6 to 8 plays of Shakespeare and to use those plays, or a close reading of those plays, to illustrate an aspect of the question of territory. So to do the idea of colonial territory, say through The Tempest, that's a fairly obvious one, or maybe Pericles, I haven't decided on that. Or to do the question of division of territory through King Lear, which is a fairly, the beginning of King Lear, there's the division of the kingdom between his three daughters and the questions that come out from that. But the whole play is around the political economy of land. So the whole subplot with Gloucester with his two sons, one of whom's a legitimate child and the other one who isn't, you unpossessing bastard. In other words, you're a bastard son who cannot possess my land. You cannot inherit my land. So the whole subplot is about the political economy of land. You can say that when you quote Shakespeare, of course, you see. What other ones do I want to do? I kind of like the idea of doing something about the administration of territory through maybe Measure for Measure. Doing something on the political body, corporeal territories, through Coriolanus, which, of course, Coriolanus is now back in the news because there's the new film version. Which is well worth seeing if you haven't seen it. It's really, it does a lot of violence to the text, but it's a really powerful piece of cinema. So that's the kind of idea, is to take these plays to illustrate questions around division, conquest, imperial territory, administration of territory, and to try to think through aspects of the question of territory by using Shakespeare's plays as ways into it. So not that it would tell us something about late 16th, early 17th century notions in particular, but you can do something with it. So there's a book that I just discovered after I'd come up with this idea by Steve Mentz, which is called At the Bottom of Shakespeare's Ocean, which actually does something very similar with thinking about the sea and taking different plays of Shakespeare's to think about different activities that humans have either on the ocean or in the ocean, so swimming, boating, fishing, beach combing, and to use the plays to illustrate these kinds of questions. And I think it's a really nice book that opens up those questions. It's a similar kind of idea with it. But I quite often end up writing about literature as a kind of, I'm not going to use the word distraction, as a way of dealing with a period that's a sort of an uncertain period. So I'm in limbo on The Birth of Territory. Until I get the final reports, I don't know what I'm going to do or what I need to do to it. And I've done this a few times. So I wrote a paper on Beowulf when I was in limbo on that book. I wrote a piece on Lefebvre's reading of Rabelais when I was waiting to hear whether I got the job at Durham. For some reason, I seem to go to these literary texts because it seems like it's a different way of working. And you can work with a relatively small amount of material if you're working with a single text and you're trying to do a close reading of that. So it's something you can do when you're on the road. So I wrote the King Lear paper when I was stuck in a hotel in Virginia after the 2010 AAG, when the volcanic eruption happened and I couldn't fly home. And I had King Lear with me and a laptop. And so I wrote a paper on King Lear. I didn't really have much else to do. I was stuck in some tiny little town in Virginia near the airport waiting for the next flight to get back. So
it was an interesting time, isn't it?
It was an interesting time for other reasons for you, but let's not go there.
No. One of the other forthcoming projects you've got is, you told me, tentatively titled The Space of the World. So with a sort of modest title like that, what's that going to be?
The idea with that, I mean, it's not a modest title, it's not a very tentative title, but the idea with that is to say there's all of this interesting philosophical work on the concept of the world. There's a whole range of writers who've tried to theorise the world. And then there's all the political and geographical work on globalisation, and the two don't seem to be in conversation with each other. And I thought that maybe bringing those two together, so the philosophical work is almost completely detached from any kind of empirical political detail, and a lot of the literature on globalisation is pretty limited conceptually. So what happens if you bring these two together? And the idea was to do it through taking questions or problems as ways into this question, because it's far too huge a question to do it comprehensively. So there's a chapter, and this is the one chapter that's completely written of that book, called Fossils. And it's because one of the, I think, interesting philosophers, a French philosopher, Quentin Meyersou, uses the question of fossils to challenge the way that we think about the human-world relation. And he suggests that a lot of continental philosophy after Kant has basically said you can only say things about the world in relation to how we know what we say about the world. So that the human is privileged in their relation to the world. That absolute objective knowledge is impossible. All knowledge is filtered through the way that we know that thing. And Meyersou's claim is there are things of which that existed not simply just before humans, but before life, of which we can have objective knowledge, which are either fossils, fossilized remains of plants, animals and stuff, or what he calls archae fossils, which are things like radioactive isotopes decaying, or the light from dead stars that we can still see through telescopes. So if that thing that we are gaining knowledge of precedes life or sentient life, how do people that have this question of the human-world relation make sense of that? So the idea then is to talk through the history of paleontology and to use philosophers that do engage with it, because Leibniz, Kant and Foucault all talk about fossils in different places, and to try to use that to use the question of fossils as a way in to thinking about the relation between a kind of a very empirical question, what we can see in fossils, what we can observe there, and the way that we relate to the question of the world and the age of the world. Because the key thing that fossils did first when they were discovered and people realised what they were was it challenged biblical accounts of the age of the world. And it challenged humans' relation to the age of the world, because if you believe the biblical account, humans were only 6 days younger than the world. If you then open up deep time, then that changes the human relation to the world. So that's one chapter, the idea of using fossils as a way into thinking about a philosophical problem that relates to an empirical question. And then I want to do a chapter on volume, if you think about spaces, places, territories as three-dimensional rather than two-dimensional, mm. we often seem to think of these things as areas. So what happens if we take airspace and the subsoil seriously? And you can engage with, the idea is to engage with Peter Sloterdijk's work on spheres through taking quite empirical political questions to think about that. So that's the idea of having different ways into this question of the world. But I'm kind of, I don't know where I'm going with this at the moment. Okay. I'm sort of drifting a bit on that one. I've clearly got very distracted by Shakespeare. That's really,
So much of the work you've done on territory was done on a three-year major research fellowship from Leverhulme. Now that that's over and you're back to teaching at Durham, are you glad to be back teaching? Are you enjoying that?
Qualified, yes. I really like teaching. But unfortunately, that's only part of what being in British higher education is. And it seems to be a decreasingly important thing. There's this strange tension between how important teaching is in terms of National Student Survey and the tuition fees increase and so on, and yet the bureaucracy that surrounds teaching supposedly to mean that our teaching is better. I keep thinking it's actually making that worse, because I taught for one term in America at UCLA, and 90-95% of the effort went into preparing the class, giving the class, talking to students outside the class, which is the way it should be. I couldn't say that 95% of the effort in the UK goes into those three things. And those are the things that I like, and those are the things that are important, and I think are the things that we need to put the effort into. I don't believe that all of the teaching quality, capital letters T and Q, is actually improving the quality of our teaching. And that's the thing that I'm finding after it was 4 years, eventually it made into a break from teaching. Mm. And coming back, and even in those 4 years, the difference of the bureaucracy, the meetings, the form filling, it's gone crazy, and it's going in the wrong direction, because the thing that it's aiming towards, I think, is the thing that's diminishing. Mm. And that's very frustrating to come back into that. Mm. And none of my colleagues at Durham would be surprised at me saying this, but I suspect most people, whichever university you're in, you will have experiences of this kind of question. Mm. So that's difficult. Mm. It's also a change being back in County Durham. Mm-hmm. You have to be honest. Mm-hmm. County Durham is a marvellous place for about 2 months a year. It's hard work for the other 10. It's a very long way north. Mm. That's really noticeable.
You recently moved house, and you wrote on your blog this great piece about the challenge of moving your library. Do you want to tell us about that? How many books do you have, Stuart?
It's probably 2,000 or 3,000.
Okay. Have you read them all?
That's often the question. I've read most of them, and I've read a lot of others that I don't know. But it's a working library. I mean, that's the point of it, is that it's there as a resource, and it's there as something I use and work with. And, you know, I don't get every book off the shelf every day, but there is something that I can just... There's the Foucault. It's right behind me. I can just pull it off. I've got them all. I've got them all in French and English, and I can just... It's straight there, and I... That kind of way of working is important to me. And so the things that are in my home study are the things I use most frequently. So all the Foucault and all the Heidegger and all the Nietzsche and Lefebvre is all there. And the office is a little bit of these are ones I've read or I might use for teaching one day, kind of.
The university office.
Okay. Which has got a lot more than home.
So where do you write? You write at home?
I write it almost exclusively at home.
And how
or in libraries. I write a lot in libraries.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. How you wrote about how getting your study right for writing was a key priority. How do you write?
Slowly. And I know people don't think this can be true, but I just write every day, or I try to write every day. Mm. And most texts, I mean, there are some exceptions, I'll maybe come to that in a minute, but most texts are built up slowly and written and overwritten, and they kind of they build. I don't start at the beginning and write through to the end. I put in quotations, I write commentary about the quotations, and that becomes something. And then maybe I'll put two of those together and think, okay, there's maybe the beginning of two sections of something. And so I often write the middles, and I write out from a middle to an article or something like that. And so articles, I don't normally know what the next article is I'm going to write, because, I mean, in the books I have a sense of what I might be working on, because that's broad projects that I'm going to think about. But articles tend to come about. So the most recent one I submitted on Leibniz, and it was because I'd done some stuff on Leibniz and territory for the Birth of Territory book. I'd done some stuff on Leibniz on fossils, because he writes about those in the fossils paper. I've got interested in the idea that Leibniz was an interesting historian. He actually, that was the main job that he had, was working for the Duke of Hanover as the court historian. And he wrote thousands and thousands of pages of material for a history of the Hanoverian royal family. And then the very interesting book came out on him as a biologist, and so I kind of took some notes about that, and then it was just, okay, maybe there's a paper here on Leibniz in all of these different registers, speaking across the range of geography as a discipline. And then it was, once I decided that, then it was just, right, put all these bits together and then top and tail it and polish it and write through it and smooth it, and then there's a paper. But something like The Birth of Territory was just, I mean, there are bits in the Birth of Territory manuscript that were written in 2000, and it was submitted in 2011, which is one of the reasons I say slowly. It's I write on a lot of things in parallel rather than one thing at a time, which is why I can say, you know, I have these ideas for three books. I'm not going to write them all, you know, next week or something, but it's that they've all been brewing for different times. And then there are the deadline papers, you know, the short pieces or a book review. I mean, a couple of book chapters that are published were sort of written in a long weekend. So I have got a different style of writing if I absolutely have to, and of why did I say yes to this kind of type writing. There are nodding people in the room. And then you just sit down and you write. And if I really set my mind to it, I can write 800 to 1,000 words an hour if I have to. But okay. I don't do that very often.
Okay.
And I really don't do that very often.
And you've recently become quite a serious blogger. What function does the blog have for you? Do all serious academics now need a blog?
Oh, I don't know about that. I never intended it to be as read as it appears to have become. Mm-hmm. That has caught me something by surprise. I think possibly it was a slight antidote. I mean, when I started it, I was working on the Birth of Territory manuscript, and I was really, you are not going to write anything other than this until it is finished. But the blog felt like a kind of permission to say something a little bit different or something. So I wrote things about the closure of Middlesex Philosophy Department. That was one of the first things I said something about. And then, because I was living in London at the time, you know, the 2010 election, some of which I saw happening very close, because I was actually living in Westminster, so that was sort of a daily kind of thing that was going on, the bloody news helicopters above the flat all the time for about 5 days when there was that uncertainty and stuff. So there were things like that I wrote, and then it became I found this interesting, maybe somebody else will, type notice board as well. And then I was writing bits about the process of writing the book, which for me was quite interesting to sort of reflect on, not give too much of the book away, but talk about the writing of the book, and particularly the final shaping of each chapter, the sort of penultimate draft of each chapter, as I was pulling material from maybe over a 10-year period and pulling it together to try and make it fit together and make it not look like, you know, here's me in my 20s and here's me in my late 30s kind of style, but actually make it a cohesive thing. So I wrote about the process of that. I mean, recently, and this is a product of me being busier and teaching, is I've done less writing about my own work, and it's become more of a, here's an interesting conference, or I read this book on the train the other day, it was kind of good, you might want to look at it, type stuff, which is, I hope I don't simply become that, because there are other things that do that. I'm amazed people read it. And I quite often find people, and I'm like, you read my blog? Wow, that's kind of odd. And you sort of think, God, what have I said? What have I said on there that you wouldn't expect this person who knows a bit of your life to now know about you because it happened to be on your blog? And they read it because it's maybe, I don't know, it's the useful notice board of events that they might find interesting too. And then you talk about, you know, the incompetent removal firm or something that you had, you know, and that there's that kind of bits of your life. I mean, I'm quite careful. There are some things I will not talk about on my blog, of course. I save that for Facebook. Yeah.
And a more serious responsibility you have, and a major time responsibility you have, is editing Society and Space. What's that been like? What does that, what does that do for your work?
It's an amazing privilege, and I really mean that. I mean, this journal's now in its 30th volume, and I'm only the third editor. I mean, many of the journals in the discipline, you know, and Society and Space was sort of founded in geography but exceeded geography. It always, if you look back at the very early issues, it always intended to be more than a geography journal. But it is a journal that geographers, I think, feel an attachment to, particularly certain types of geographers feel it's an important journal. But if you look at most of the discipline's journals, the editors have changed much more frequently than that. Some of them, the society journals, so Transactions or Area or the Annals, have a 3-year term maybe. Maybe sometimes people will do a second term, but they have a defined time period. Society and Space doesn't. Michael Deer was editor for 10 years, Jerry Pratt was editor for 14 years, and I mean, I've now done nearly six. And I get the sense that if I was to stop soon, you know, some people would think, well, you were in and out. But 6 years is a long time. And the volume of submissions that we get compared to those early days, that's astonishing. It's an enormous time commitment. I mean, just the first full year I was editor, there were 132 submissions. Last year, there were 260. And that's in a 5-year from... Yeah. So that's... And that's five a day. Five a week.
How many did you publish a year then? Six volumes?
It's about 45 to 50, something in that region. So, you know, that's one every... Well, it's five a week, so it's one every working day a week, one new manuscript coming in. And anything that we publish has probably been read by the editors 4 or 5 times at different stages. Just that alone... Let alone making a decision, getting the reports, reading the reports, adjudicating, talking. You know, that alone is a huge time commitment. But it, I mean, I get to see the best work in a field a lot earlier than anybody else does. You know, and that's an interesting thing. That's a privilege. And you can also do things with it. I mean, we were talking about theory earlier. So one of the things we did that was quite early on was a special issue on Peter Sloterdijk, who's a German philosopher that I think could be picked up in geography and used, and because his work on spheres and so on is obviously spatial. And the idea with that very early project, and it came out at the beginning of 2009, but it was in plan in 2007, was, okay, let's commission some translations, let's get some people from different disciplines to talk about these questions, let's make the first engagement really within geography sort of like the later engagements with thinkers that have sometimes happened, that, you know, there's the slightly, oh, I've discovered this theorist, isn't he interesting? Let's spatialise them. Kind of not great papers, but they're doing something new. And then somebody along the line comes along and says, you know, maybe we should slow down and read them in context and try to do this, and maybe a bit of attention to the original language. Society and Space gave me the possibility of being able to do something like that on a thinker early on. And then in the most recent issue, there's a section on Claude Raffestin, who's a really important Swiss geographer who almost nobody in Anglophone geography knows because relatively little of his work has been translated. But he's extremely important in Francophone geography and in Italian geographical debates as well. And so this gave us the opportunity. We commissioned him to write a sort of like a career summation piece, a quite long piece, introducing his work to an Anglophone audience, which we then translated. And then four pieces that are talking about his work and putting it into relation with Anglophone debates and so on. That kind of thing the journal allows me to be able to do, which is, I mean, it's very time consuming, but it's, I think it's interesting.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming and talking to us. I want to open the floor up now to anybody who has questions for Stuart. Not everybody at once. There you go.
You say that you do publications which will have work that you've done spanning over a decade. How do you take notes and collate them together?
That's only that one book, really, that spans that period of time. But I take all my notes into the computer, or I type them up soon after. So if I take them, if I'm in a library and I've only got a laptop with me or something, then paper with me rather than the laptop, I would then type the notes up soon after, partly because my handwriting's bad and I can't read my own handwriting if I leave it too long. But if you have everything in your computer, then you can find everything or anything whenever you need to. If you think, I remember I read a book on this. It's not very systematic, but the way, Google Desktop or something like that will help you find whatever file it's in that you took stuff. So, yeah, I mean, if I, if all my backup systems failed and I lost my hard drive, I'd be have to start again. So I suppose it's not very good. I mean, if I look back at the notes I took in the first couple of years of my PhD, they were terrible. They're absolutely useless. And I suppose one of the things about writing all the time is I make sense of what I've been reading and thinking. And I may not publish it, but that's actually not the point. Writing for me is part of the process of research. It's not writing up research. I know this is more of a sort of physical science model of kind of you do the research, you think about it, and then you write it. And that for me has never been the way that I do it. I write to make sense of what I'm reading and thinking. And I may well throw what I've written away, or I overwrite it and rewrite it and rethink it and so on. But I forget stuff, so that's one of the reasons I write, because it helps me to make sense of what I'm thinking, and then I've got some kind of record of it. It's not very systematic, is it? It's not sort of, you couldn't teach this as research training or something, but yeah. And this is, it's not the same question, but co-writing is a really, really strange process for me, anyway. I don't know how other people who've done any co-writing with other people have found it. But, when I let go of something, I've kind of tried to polish it and smooth it out and make it look vaguely presentable and stuff. But everything up to the last draft is a right mess. And exposing that to a co-writer is actually quite a strange process, because they get to see the beginning kind of process, or the how maybe chaotic or disorganised you are up until that late point in the process. I write a lot of instructions to myself in when I'm writing. This bit is rubbish. You don't have an argument. What's the evidence here? Those kinds of things. I put those in square brackets so I know to make sure I delete them all before I submit it to a journal, because otherwise you write your own referee reports. But and I do that because then that helps me to make sense of where I'm at with the thinking on this bit and so on. And so exposing that potentially to other people. I mean, this is why writing with somebody is interesting. Sorry, that's not really the same question. But.
Any more? Phil? Yes.
I just wanted to ask you, Stuart, whether you think we sort of beat ourselves up a little bit about the whole theory thing. Right at the beginning of your talk, you were talking about the way in which, well, geographers have come late. But there are plenty of disciplines, and I've published a fair bit of history journals, but you go to history conferences and people come up to you and say, you're a geographer, tell me about space. Where shall I start? And geography has a certain kind of reputation for being up to the minute in some kind of a theoretical engagement. And it always strikes me that historians sometimes, sort of pick and choose in a much more magpie-like way than we do in terms of theory. So they sometimes use, and this is not evident, but they sometimes use whatever theory backs up the particular points that they've already decided that they want to make. And it seems to me actually geography in some ways is more honest about the way it engages with theory than some other disciplines, let's say. I mean, it's not by all means all the branches of history, but history is a very broad church, and there are some areas of history which are still stunningly empiricist in that sense of, well, you know, we don't want to have anything to do with any of that theoretical lingua franca.
I think there's something in that, and particularly history is a good example to pick of that. I mean, I had a history teacher lecturer when I was an undergraduate who said, good history is always boring. Because if it's not boring, it's not good history. Because good history should be the cataloguing. It should be the listing. It should be the enumeration of all of the things that you found in the archive. And that as soon as you start to make it interesting, you must be doing interpretation. Kind of interpretation that's not good history, you know. And there is that in history of ideas, I don't think there is quite that, which is the history that I'm more, in a sense, familiar with. And I think that there's a lot of very interesting debates in that and historiography, which are not guilty of those sort of crimes, maybe that you're suggesting. I mean, there is a problem in the sort of, you know, if a discipline becomes theoretical, or something, then suddenly everybody has got to kind of develop their own theory, or you get, you know, what's your ontology? I mean, what a ridiculous question that is. As if you just, well, I made it up this morning on the bus. Here's my ontology. I mean, it's just such a ridiculous, crass question, but this idea that people are supposed to have some kind of hugely developed theoretical framework through which they're filtering all of the things that are coming to them, it's just...
Could you have crossed that off my
list? Yeah, question. Did you? What's your ontology? But, you know, I've heard those kinds of questions asked of PhD students. To show some awareness of those kinds of questions and to push beyond a sort of a, you know, what I call a naive empiricism type thing, I think is worthwhile. But I don't, this is the point, I don't think everybody needs to go away and work on these thinkers in their own right as thinkers and so on. And, you know, this is... I mean, I kind of get annoyed when people write on a thinker and don't do the kind of careful textual, contextual scholarship on that thinker. But that's different from people who use a bit of a thinker in order to get from A to B in their argument or to say something interesting about what they're looking at and so on. Mm. So I don't think everybody who does that, but people who've tried to write a paper on, you know, Badiou or a Gambin or something like that, I do think there are things that are legitimate to expect of a paper that's making that kind of argument that often have not been there. And that's just, I think, quite a different argument, but I think that's a more valid one. Yeah.
My question is about the knowing that Foucault was such a kind of knockout of old theories, especially against narratives in the post-structural construction idea, how would you say that we now have to face Foucault as not really narrative, but unquestionable theory? How are we going beyond the ghost of Foucault?
I think that's a great question, because there is this, and I think it's particularly coming from the lecture courses, which I don't really understand, because those are obviously the most tentative thought in process, kind of, you know, you're seeing reading a brain in action. He's on the spot thinking stuff through. And yet, you know, the one that has most been an issue for me is this territory used to be the object of political power, and now it's population. And that story that Foucault talks about in the Security Territory Population lectures, that there's been a shift away from territory, which was the object of government, if you find it in the Middle Ages and in Machiavelli, and that now in the modern period, the object of government is never territory, the object of government is the people, and then maybe their relation to a set of questions of which territory might be one. Now that story, which Foucault kind of goes through and really is using as a setup in order that he can then interrogate the question of population and think about the work on biopolitics, has become almost as if this is the story, this is the Western political thought story. It's just not true. It just does not work. The argument he's making, I mean, I just don't buy the argument that the Middle Ages had territory as its object of political power. It's just not there. It's definitely not there in Machiavelli. And the thinkers that Foucault thinks are the break with that, therefore, are more of a continuity with that than a break. And that actually territory emerges as a category of political theory after Foucault thinks it's disappeared. And that seems to me, with the big historical work I've done on territory, to be a much more defensible story, because I think you can reinforce it with the references and the texts and the arguments and so on. And yet what Foucault has said there has just become like this unquestioned, well, it must be true. Now, what Foucault's virtue is for me is Foucault asks great questions. he generates really productive concepts or approximations to make sense of things. But let's not pretend that he's always the best historian, the most careful archivist, the most diligent reader of texts. He's not. And he didn't claim to be. And that's the important thing. This is why I don't think I'm kind of saying something truly heretical to Foucault, but I think Foucauldians don't like this. But I think that for me is... So for me, it's let's pick up on the sensibility or the attunement or the mode of operating or something that Foucault had, rather than think that everything that he says about any particular instance or moment or sign is true. The same is true multiple ways in Agamben. I mean, some of Agamben's arguments just seem to me to be absolutely crazy. And yet, they come back as if this is... Well, of course, we all know that there was a rigid distinction in Greek thought between these two forms of life, Zoe and Bios. No, we don't. It's not. It's not true. It's not rigid. It's blurred. It's complicated. It's nuanced in all sorts of ways. And yet it now gets... You know, you can say this in the opening paragraph of an essay and then you go on and do whatever you want with that category. And that's where I think there's a real problem, because I don't think these thinkers themselves thought people should appropriate their work in that way. So that, for me, is you pick up the way they wrote rather than the necessary detail absolutely follow everything that they wrote. Maybe that would move us beyond those kind of... And Lefebvre, I mean, Lefebvre's been hugely important to me as a thinker. Lefebvre makes all sorts of mistakes, and his writing's terribly clunky, and but he's still a really productive thinker. So I suppose that's where I'm at on those kind of questions, is let's not turn them into the kind of thinkers they were trying to resist.
Any more questions? Yeah, Hattie.
A lot of the literature on the Temple of Terror has sort of focused on the Middle East. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about maybe the impact of the Temple of Terror on other areas that sort of escaped our focus, like sort of North and West Africa, or like perhaps why our imagination, when we think about the Temple of Terror, we sort of focus immediately on certain areas of the world, when actually, like Bush's Pan-Sahelian initiative, why are there these invisibilities?
I don't know how much I can say in detail on those. I mean, what I tried to do in the book was to avoid just doing Iraq and Afghanistan, and that I wanted to talk about Pakistan. There's quite a bit on the book in Pakistan. Now, of course, you know, in the period from when I finished writing it to when it came out, and certainly to now, Pakistan has been much, much more the focus. But I think in 2006-07, when I was writing that material, it wasn't so much the focus, and yet there was a lot of things going on there that I thought were interesting. Lebanon also features in the book, because I didn't want to do too much on Israel-Palestine itself, but Israel's actions in Lebanon and then the continuation of those into the 2000s. I mean, Adam knows far more about that than I do. But that seemed an interesting thing to say something about. Somalia was also something I talked about in reasonable detail. Yemen, I wish I'd said a bit more about, because Yemen, of course, has become more of a focus, although then it quite quickly dropped out again. But just before bin Laden was assassinated in Pakistan, Yemen had been a target of some of these questions. And then... And this is sort of for more personal reasons, because my wife is working at that, but Nigeria. And the things that are happening in Nigeria and the way that what's happening in Nigeria is being recoded to try to make sense of it within the overall narrative of the war on terror. And this is being done by Western governments, but also by the government of Goodluck Jonathan. And there are many, many complexities in Nigeria about why these things are happening and just how cohesive is Boko Haram? Or is Boko Haram actually more of an idea that a number of different groups with different interests and different ways of operating have been able to get behind? In a similar way, actually, to the way that Al-Qaeda became less a kind of, you know, bin Laden supposedly in his cave in Afghanistan orchestrating this global network, but it became more of an idea that lots of groups could get behind because there was some kind of status to the name and the operation, and it served almost both sides quite well, because the US and its allies were able to construct this as something that they could make sense of and that they could mobilise their political forces and military forces against, but it also made sense from the militant, politicised, particular, very particular form of Islam. And I think something similar is happening with Boko Haram. I mean, when I was in Nigeria, a bomb went off in Abuja about 5 minutes after I arrived in Abuja. This was back in June last year. And then the recent events in Kano, Susan, my wife, was caught up in those. And so it's a very personal thing now. This is, you know, the terror attacks, and also the very heavy-handed response of the Nigerian government, the Nigerian military to this, has become very personal rather than the more detached academic work, which, I mean, you know, most of that book was written in Western libraries. I mean, it wasn't, I was out in the field doing this stuff. I mean, I did, you know, wandered around in Palestine and stuff, but not, I didn't go to most of the places that I wrote about in this book. Nigeria now is a much more connected. I've been to these places, I know these places, I know people there. So I think that, you know, we need to be careful that we don't tie every event of these kinds into a wider set of conspiracies and so on. One of the things I regret about that book is that map with all the terrorist attacks since 98 kind of thing in there, because I think it looks like everything's connected, and I think that's not quite what I intended, but I think I can see why it looks like that. And then why have you missed some things off but not other things and so on. But I think that you know, the Maghreb as a region, I think, is interesting, and there's work to be done about the connections there. The stories in Nigeria are, when the first suicide bomb happened in Nigeria, it couldn't be a Nigerian. This was the story that was being told in Nigeria, because I was there at the time when this happened. They must be from Niger. This was the story I kept hearing. Or they must have been trained in Sudan or Somalia, because even though there's the religious fragmentation in the country, these are still Nigerians, and they couldn't do these kinds of things. That was an interesting... It's a very different set of geopolitical relations and so on.
A final question?
Yeah. There's a couple now.
Okay, final two questions. Should we take them both together and then Stuart can
weave them together? Okay, sure.
No, I was just going to ask that you talk about how in the early after you published your book, Yemen and Pakistan and other places gained importance in the global war on terror. And one of the problems that geographers face is because it's such a contemporary subject, it's so hard to ensure that your work continues to be relevant. So can you see yourself sort of updating the work you do when publishing the various editions to include some of these developments?
Thanks, Sarah. And then what was the other question?
I think one much of a question. I'm researching in design research rather than geography, and there's a particular area of politics about that, which is the financial thrift and people like Peter Adam taking his airports and focusing the war on terror really to generate fear to get public support for it. And there are architectural and spatial forms that that generation really takes. So I have a huge interest in that. I'm wondering if you have anything to say about the politics about that as a research area, and if you're going to really go 3D rather than say geography, 2D in such space, really about three dimensional spaces.
Sure. No, that's good. I don't think I can answer them together, but I will answer them in sequence because they're a little bit too different. The updating, I'm not sure that's what I want to do, although in some ways I can see it would make sense. And, I mean, Adam's earlier question about Syria and Libya, I could conceive of how I could do either a rewritten version of the whole book or maybe a new chapter but sort of for the same reasons I said about, you know, a book on, say, the Obama administration side, it's not where my head or heart is at the moment. It's not what I'm interested in. Partly, and it's absolutely not to say there is nothing to say about those things. There is, there's loads, but it may not be for me to say it. And what I've tried, I mean, this is partly because the final finishing of a book is always unpleasant. It's always an unpleasant process, for me at least. I think it is probably for a lot of people. Just because it's a slog, and every time I get to the end of a book, I think I never want to write another book like that one. And I actually normally mean in the process, the type of style of writing the book. And the very contemporary nature of this book, of kind of where do you stop and you know, you think you've got the final draft and then an event happens. Do you modify or a new reading of some previous event? When do you stop? So the end of 2007 was when I stopped writing the book as I submitted it. Then because it took so long in review, the editors suggested that I, you know, spend, you know, a month of updating to bring it up to date, so that the moment when I gave it into that, and I said, but you're still going to take a year to publish it. So it will still be a year out of date, even if it's bang up to the moment I give it to you. And so academic publishing works in a very different way to sort of journalist schedules and so on. If you work on contemporary stuff, you just have to fight with that. And I don't think there's any easy way around it. But at the moment, I can't see myself writing on those questions, even though I think they're hugely important, and I hope other people work on them. Does that...
No.
Yeah? Affect is not where I am with stuff. There are many people doing work on it, and I mean, some of them are at Durham, colleagues who are working on those kinds of questions, so Ben Anderson, Paul Harrison, for instance. And then there are a number of people who've picked up on those ideas. It's a kind of a peculiar lineage of it. I mean, Thrift is the geography person, but there's a sort of a Deleuze version, but it's a Deleuze's reading of Spinoza. And I mean, this maybe goes to sort of this question of how theory is read in geography, is that people will talk about Spinoza says, and often it's at sort of second hand or third hand, that it's not even, it's not Spinoza, that it's Deleuze's Spinoza. And Deleuze's readings of thinkers are always peculiar and perverse and deliberately so, and he makes this explicit. I mean, Deleuze's reading of Leibniz is a very odd reading of Leibniz, for instance. So it's... Right, okay. But it's not even always Deleuze's Spinoza. It's Thrift's Deleuze's Spinoza that becomes the thing that's, you know... So there's some interesting sort of intellectual lineages to be traced, I think, around some of those questions. But Pete Addy's work on the airspace kind of questions is definitely of interest to me. Less so for the affect stuff, but more than just the thinking about the aerial, thinking about those kinds of questions. That's definitely of interest. But it's not so much on the affect side. But then this is partly because all of these disciplinary boundaries are so artificial. And, you know, even though there's probably a virtue, this comes back to the first question, really, even though there's a virtue to being trained in a discipline, you get to a certain point and you realise just how artificial those divides are. And I've never been very good at respecting those disciplinary divides. And, you know, just following where the problem takes me rather than I should read these things because I'm a political theorist or now I'm a geographer or, you know, whatever it might be. You do recognise just how artificial these questions are, but actually how important they still are, because international relations and political geography are often doing exactly the same thing. They just don't talk to each other. They don't go to each other's conferences and they're talking about exactly the same kind of problems, but they're just not engaging. That's a real problem when things like that become so entrenched as a divide. And one of the things that geography generally is good at is it doesn't make those rigid distinctions. You know, where does cultural geography stop and cultural studies begin? You know, that, I think, is a more blurred question. And I think that's a good thing. Historians and historical geography, for instance. Political geography still seems to be a little bit behind on some of those questions. But
okay. John,
on behalf of the Geographical Society, I'd like to extend a very warm thank you to Stuart Eldon for coming down from Durham, and also a massive thank you to Dr. Ramdan for agreeing to be part of this event. So, on behalf of everybody here,